This is Off Ramp. I'm John Raby. Coming up, Mark Haefeli explains why banks have pillars. But before we get to that, I want to tell you about the newest Off Ramp feature, which is not on the radio. It's Dinner Party Download. And in 9 minutes, it'll teach you everything you need to know to sparkle at your next dinner party. Rico Galliano, what you got in this week's show?
We mark the 50th anniversary of the American publication of Nabokov's Lolita. We tell you a little bit about the controversy surrounding that book, and we give you a cocktail themed after the book, if you can wrap your head around that.
I can, because I actually know a guy named Humbert.
Well, there's a name you don't hear every day.
True enough, but he was a nice guy. Find Dinner Party Download at kpcc.org. Click on Off Ramp. This is Off Ramp. I'm John Raby. Jeff Giroux, the fast food dude at the Riverside Press Enterprise and Off Ramp commentator, has been sampling one of the quintessential Coachella Valley things, and that is a date shake. We're celebrating our new repeater, which is expanding our service to the Coachella Valley. Hey, Jeff, where are you now? You've been taking your time calling back.
Yeah, I got a little lost. I'm in Thermal. Now, if you pass Thermal and you go too far, you'll end up at Mecca, and you pass Mecca, you'll eventually end up in Brawley. But you got to get really lost to end up in Brawley.
There's a Mecca in the Coachella Valley?
There is. I'm actually facing it right now.
Okay. But anyway, you're at the Oasis Date Gardens now, which is, a Mecca for date shakes. What do they tell you about this place?
Well, it was established in 1912, and it is a 175-acre working date ranch. And they specialize in the medjool date.
Yeah, they produce 1.3 million pounds of those dates every year.
Wow. All right, let's go on inside.
So far, Jeff has taken us to the Hadley Fruit Orchards in Cabazon, where he was the first customer. Then he headed to Shields Date Gardens in Indio. Of the two date shakes, he preferred the ones at Shields Date Gardens.
Now, can you add extra flavors to your date shake? So for 25 cent extra, I can add raspberry butterscotch, peanut butter, strawberry pineapple, chocolate, banana, cactus, vanilla, or pina colada. I am. I would like the large date shake with cactus, please.
Jeff, you sound a little low energy. I wonder if you're getting date shaked out.
I think I should have taken your advice. I went ahead and polished off those other two. So I don't recommend anybody try three large date shakes in a three-hour period.
The term is bilious.
So is the date in there or is the date in there? That's the date? Okay, so it's soft serve ice cream and then you add like a date mix to it. Oh, okay. And then where'd the cactus come from? So did you get all that? It's soft serve ice cream and then the date is already mixed up and it's in a plastic container. And then after they pour the soft serve ice cream, they blend it with the date. And then on top of that, they use like a cactus flavor syrup. Are you ready for the taste test?
Yes, sir.
For one thing, it's not really a milkshake. I would say it's more of an ice cream dessert. There aren't visible pieces of date like there were at Shields or even at Hadley's. It's more of just a slight flavor.
So where do you rank it? Is it number three then?
Why don't we go outside? She was such a nice woman, I didn't want to tell her she came in last place. Yeah, it was of the three, it's definitely mailing it in.
Thanks, Jeff, for testing out the date shakes for us.
Anytime I can be of service, drive out to Thermal to try a date shake for you. I'm there for you, John.
The year 2000. America is a vast speedway. People line the streets to witness the greatest drivers on earth in a race from sea to shining sea.
This is a death race.
It's a cross-country road wreck, and the traffic is murder. Death Race 2000, rated R.
Next week on Off Ramp, Paul Chihara, who wrote the score for the original Death Race 2000. He talks about working with Roger Corman.
And he said, I'm doing this movie, I just thought it up, about a race in the future from New York to Los Angeles in which people get points by running over people. I thought we could use some electronic music for the chases. But I said, no, we can do the entire score this way. And he thought, how wonderful. And I know why he thought how wonderful, because he was thinking how much money I could save.
Paul Chihara on next week's Off Ramp. Saturdays at noon, Sunday nights at 8, and always on the web at kpcc.org. This is Off Ramp. I'm John Raby. The rock band Princeton, based in Eagle Rock, has a new album. It's called Bloomsbury. Rico Galliano, co-host of Dinner Party Download, asked band member Jesse Kivel why.
The Bloomsbury Group is actually sort of a rebellion against Victorian era ideals. There was a lot of art and literature being thrown around. The record itself, though, is capturing individual portraits of four people in the Bloomsbury Group. Virginia Woolf, Lytton Strachey, Leonard Woolf, and John Maynard Keynes.
What attracted you to these figures as a young guy? You're how old?
I'm 22.
Most 22-year-old guys are, you know, what are young 22-year-old guys doing these days?
I'm not sure exactly. But
drinking.
Maybe drinking. I drink a little bit, but not enough to impair my studies, I guess. I think we were studying abroad in London, and I had written this song when we came home about Leonard Woolf.
And just for those who don't know, like me, who is Leonard Woolf?
Leonard Woolf is, I mean, I hate to start with Virginia Woolf's husband, but he is. Basically, he wrote books about politics, and he started Hogarth Press with Virginia Woolf, which is pretty legendary. And I kept going to the library in London, and I'd see Virginia Woolf, and she had this rows and rows of books and books criticism about her. And then I'd see the Leonard Woolf stack, and it was much shorter. And I just said, this must be really rough for Leonard. That must have been hard to be Virginia Woolf's husband.
So Leonard Woolf, don't cry. Your books will one day speak to me. And when they do, we'll run outside and tell your wife, tell your wife, tell your wife, tell your wife.
And the other songs, we just got excited about the idea. And we're just like, let's fill this out. Let's do this concept a little further.
It's interesting how coming up with a concept that seems restrictive can actually be freeing.
I totally agree with that. I feel anything I can do to feel like I'm not writing one of my songs. If I say to myself, Jesse, sit down and write a Princeton song, you know, the results are never good. But if I can have fun with an idea, like write a song with a tropical rhythm, really helps, I think, the creative process for me.
In LA, it seems like a lot of music is based on partying, the beach. This is a type of music that takes as its theme, you know, studies.
Right.
Is there an audience for it?
I think surprisingly, we've found an audience here. We know, I think, our audience a bit better, and our shows are geared to having a good time. I didn't want to go up on stage and go, let me tell you a little bit about Virginia Woolf and then go into a monologue about Virginia Woolf.
I don't know, man. I think a blackboard is like a spectacular rock prop that I haven't seen often enough.
We should use that. We try and go with anything that sounds appealing for the moment.
Vanessa used to say, when I grew up, I would learn to work and drive home every night to a big estate with a pretty wife, but
the band Princeton. They're from Eagle Rock, and they're just about to start touring, opening for Throw Me the Statue, the band from Seattle. Their first show is at the Echo, September 10. Jesse Kivel of Princeton spoke with Rico Galliano, co-host of Dinner Party Download, which you can find at kpcc.org. Click on Off Ramp. That's also where we keep all the information about Princeton. Ever wonder why old banks, Mississippi mansions, and public schools and libraries look like Roman temples? Or why Washington is piled so high with marble monuments? Or why Grandma's little blue cream pitcher has little naked sculpted kids prancing around on it? Off-Ramp commentator Mark Hafley says one answer to this question goes back 50 years before our country's foundation.
It goes back to a secret society of Britain's best and brightest. No, this isn't about the Hellfire Club or the Da Vinci Code. It's not even quite a conspiracy, except in the most benign sense. Maybe you could call it a conspiracy to bring the art and feeling of ancient Greece and Rome into modern times. It was a conspiracy that succeeded, all the way from Eastern Europe to our Western shores and beyond. It's all laid out in a handsome, unusual show called The Society of Dilettanti, now running at the Getty Villa. According to co-curator Bruce Radford, it all began in 1734, when a batch of apparently jobless but quite rich young Englishmen discovered they shared a love far deeper than the usual drink and dalliance of the 18th century. They had a passion for ancient Italy and Greece. They acquired it by taking the grand tour of Europe via coach and canal boat, sailing ship, horseback, and on foot. It was said that no young man, however long he attended Oxford, was truly educated if he didn't personally know the galleries of the Vatican and Florence, the churches of Venice, or if he were really brave, the Turkish-occupied ruins of classical Greece. To share their precious experiences, these men formed the Society of Dilettanti. Now, today, dilettante implies lightweight, but back then it simply meant that you took delight in something. And that delight was shown in their Latin motto, Seria Ludo, which you could translate as playful seriousness. In this spirit, English noblemen such as Robert Darcy, John Monckton, and Charles Sackville hosted riotous meetings, drank hundreds of gallons of rum punch, collected classic erotica, and commissioned myriad pictures, many of themselves, as they gathered great antique art from Italy and Greece. And then, unlike most secret societies, they opened their doings to the world. They painted the landscapes of ancient ruins, mapped lost cities, portrayed their treasures, and finally gathered all their findings into huge published volumes. These volumes inspired architects like Robert Adam, painters such as Joshua Reynolds, sculptors like Canova, and even potters like Josiah Wedgwood, who mass-produced your grandma's classic cream pitcher in his quest to bring dilettante values to the Victorian middle-class breakfast table. The exhibition, which is really about how the world got itself classified, runs through October at the Getty Villa. For Off-Ramp, I'm Mark Haefeli.
Over the last hour on Off-Ramp, we've learned a lot about the Coachella Valley as we've celebrated our new transmitter at 90.3 FM KPCV. It's based in Coachella. And we'll do a lot more stories from the CV in the future. But one question that's really a burning question, pardon the pun, that we haven't answered yet, is how come, when back long before air conditioning, people moved to the Coachella Valley when daytime temperatures reached up past 100 or 110? We turned again to local historian Pat Laughlin, who's lived in the Coachella Valley since 1948.
Well, it was early farmland, and agriculture was the primary industry in the country at that time, and nobody saw any hopes for this place when it was just desert. But as soon as the Southern Pacific Railroad came through and put down some deep wells that got into the underground aquifer that lies under this valley, and water was available, it came out under artesian pressure, actually. It would shoot 10 feet in the air. As soon as water was put on this land, which is not just sterile sand, it's the topsoil, actually, that was washed down by the Colorado River and in the creation of the Grand Canyon, and all of that flowed in here. That's a whole nother story. So this was good land. There was water on it, and because of the higher temperature, it was early. It produced early crops. So with the railroad to deliver the crops to eastern markets and the chance to get in on the higher prices, now we have strawberries or watermelons 12 months of the year, but for a long time, the first fruits or vegetables on the market always got the premium prices, and so it was an opportunity. And the women, many of them just, you know, went up into the mountains for the summertime with the children. Or my mother-in-law went into Los Angeles, where her parents lived, and took my husband with her when he was a little boy. But the men stayed through the heat of the summer and persevered and developed this into what it is now. You know, it was. But even when I came here in 1948, people felt so sorry for me going to that hot place, you know. But fortunately, air conditioning came along.
Pat Laughlin, an ex-school teacher who's lived in the Coachella Valley since 1948. Thanks to her, to Jackson Musker, and to Jeff Giroux for helping us explore the Coachella Valley on this edition of Off Ramp. And that's Off Ramp for another week. Off Ramp came to you from producer Queena Kim, editor Nick Roman, and executive producer Paul Glickman. Off Ramp, Saturdays at noon, Sunday nights at 8, and always on the web at kpcc.org, where you can listen to the show or download a podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm John Raby.